point of view, yes, we can. Then you say, can we pay for it? The answer is almost certainly no. And then the third is, you know, even ignoring what I've said before, like that this is just an irresponsible question to ask, but we'll put that aside. Will there still be an appetite for it when this actually starts getting built in the fantasy world where it does? Or hopefully some of these ideas that I've been talking about, these alternatives to the private automobile, that's where we really put our attention and our energy and our money into. So by the time we're actually at like, all right, somehow we found the money for it, somehow it's not going to collapse and kill a bunch of people, then do we still want to do this? Is this the best use of public funds? And I mean, if we're being honest, I don't see that truthful answer ever being like, yes, this is the best way to spend our limited resources.
There's a highlight from a recent episode of The North State. Find new episodes at host Scott Martin's thecatch.ca Substack and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Progress Report from Edmonton-based public interest journalism outlet Progress Alberta has been detailing the good and mostly bad of Alberta politics since 2019. On this highlight from a new episode, co-hosts Jim Story and Jeremy Appel sit down with Drug Data Decoded's Juan Thompson to talk about his investigation into the Calgary police's use of facial recognition technology. Now, here's Jeremy and Jim.
Friends and enemies, welcome to another episode of the Progress Report podcast. It is August 7th. We're recording in Amiskwichi, Muskegon, otherwise known as Edmonton, Alberta, in Treaty 6 territory. I am one of your co-hosts, Jim Story, and our co-host, Jeremy Appel, is with us. And today, our guest is friend of the show, Ewan Thompson. Fellas, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. How's it going on your end, Jim?
A little sleepy. It's been muggy here in Edmonton. It's been hard to get a good night's sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, things are going good for me as well. I'm not unlike you, not sleeping the best, but overall, I feel like most of that is just worrying about some of the repercussions of stories being put out and so on than anything else.
But today, I think we've got a little bit of kind of a news roundup episode between the two of you. You've got some big scoops, and while I think we want to spend the bulk of the conversation today on Ewan's latest work about police surveillance from CPS, the Calgary Police Service, before we get into it, I want to highlight a couple of Progress Report stories that Jeremy has done, just in case any of our listeners out there are regular, you know, pod hearers, but not website lookers. Jeremy, you have had a good week in reporting, a couple of bangers. I want to start off telling people about the most recent one, the one that you just put up yesterday. So you looked into some financial disclosures around a trip by the premier. For our listeners, what's that all about?
Yeah, so if you remember, the premier went in March down to Florida, her second trip to the state in 3 months. The first time was to go to Mar-a-Lago and hang out with Kevin O'Leary and Donald Trump. This one was to speak at a fundraiser for PragerU alongside Ben Shapiro. PragerU is not a university. It is a right-wing propaganda mill that produces short videos about how climate change is fake, slavery wasn't so bad, and that Israel has a right to do whatever it wants. I did some reporting on that for your brother, Ewan, Jimmy, at the Canada's National Observer when that event was first announced, soon after it was first announced in early March. I've done stories before going through the government's expense disclosures. For example, I did a piece for Ricochet last year, maybe 2 years ago, about the provincial delegation to COP28 in Dubai, and how much money they spent on that. And, you know, it's always an interesting thing to go through. Of course, you know, a decade ago, it was a huge scandal when Alison Redford spent $45,000 flying privately to Nelson Mandela's funeral. And this would be, you know, kind of the opposite. I'm sure PragerU has some interesting beliefs about Nelson Mandela and, you know, whether he was a terrorist or not. But I found that the premier's office spent almost $20,000 going to this fundraiser for PragerU, which they justified as, you know, just spreading Alberta's message to, you know, an influential audience that does have the ear of President Trump. And basically, her entourage was her plus four people, including her chief of staff, Rob Anderson, Sam Blackett, her press secretary, and two tour and advance coordinators. You know, I found that Rob Anderson's expenses were far more than anyone else's. Back in January, when they took the first trip to Florida, the CBC reported that he had flied business class one of the ways there, and he responded by saying that he actually has a rare blood condition that makes it so he has to fly first class on flights longer than 3 hours because he needs to keep his legs up, otherwise he could have like a blood clot. He could die if he doesn't fly first class. And you know, in the travel expense policy that the government has, I mean, there is a clause saying that, you know, you're supposed to fly economy, but if you have a legitimate medical reason, you can fly business class. Supposedly, he had a doctor's note that says so. But what was interesting is that it was for flights over 3 hours. And so Anderson took four flights, right? There was a flight to, the first flight was from Calgary to Vancouver, then Vancouver to Miami. And then the flight back was from Miami to Montreal and Montreal to Calgary. So all those flights are over 3 hours, except for the first one, Calgary to Vancouver, which is an hour, 2 hours, depending on which way the wind's blowing. This one was closer to 2 hours. And he still flew business class. Even though the flight was less than 3 hours. And it wasn't just, he didn't just fly business class. If you look at the hotel expenses, he bought a more expensive room than everyone else at the hotel. You know, more expensive by like, you know, I think everyone else was paying like, you know, $240 US a night, and he was paying like $310, right? Which is like substantially more expensive. And so you see his hotel expense in Canadian dollars for two nights was $1,100, and everyone else's were around, you know, $600, $500. So there's that. He also took some really expensive cab rides. We're talking like $170, which I think was because he flew into Miami rather than Fort Lauderdale. And so going from Miami to Boca Raton, I mean, it's going to be a pretty expensive cab ride. I believe Fort Lauderdale is closer, though I do not have a map of Florida in front of me.
But it was really, really tough for him having to spend all this money, or having to spend all of other people's money, because his blood doesn't work. That must be really frustrating for a small government conservative to have to get all these fancy hotel rooms.
Well, yeah, and I mean, if you go back to the government's expenses for the Dubai trip, they were staying at a luxury resort. That was very expensive, which again the government said, well, it was the closest hotel to the venue. Again, the policy is quite vague in terms of that, like the government is supposed to, you know, get the most value for their dollars, while also keeping other things in mind, like proximity, you know, medical conditions or other business and like business reasons why they might have to, you know, spend more money. So, I mean, you can get away with that. And I don't think, I you know, I have no reason to believe that the premier broke any law. Certainly, or Rob Anderson or anyone in her entourage, I'm of course not suggesting that. You know, it is telling that the premier's office spent $20,000 to go down to Florida to help a far-right propaganda mill fundraise, and they raised over $1 million at this event. Now, I'm not saying that was because Danielle Smith was there. I think most people in, you know, Florida aren't familiar with her. You know, it was using public funds to benefit a private foreign interest. You know, we don't know whether, you know, members of the delegation paid out of their own pocket, say, for a seat at this event, whether they were comped or they had to pay $1,500 US for a seat, which is the price, or if they bought merchandise, because then that would be, you know, a donation. Yeah. And it's using public funds to get to this place where they can donate to PragerU.
Yeah, that's what really does it for me on this story. I am generally not too interested in these. A politician spent too much on a trip, Bev Oda, orange juice type stories. For one reason being that these narratives typically are only useful to right-wing politicians. It never seems to be conservative politicians who get in trouble for any of this kind of stuff, because I think it's the conservative base that mostly gets mad about expenses. So, I mean, you'll see a big furor over, you know, the Notley delegation not all taking buses to a climate conference, but you won't hear the same kind of thing about a politician on the right. But this PragerU story is a little different from just like, oh, this guy spent too much money. Like, we're effectively talking about a large in-kind donation from the government of Alberta to this organization, PragerU, which, as you described earlier on, is not an educational institution. It's not a charitable organization. This is like a Daily Wire, Breitbart adjacent right-wing propaganda, like far-right propaganda outfit that hosts the likes of Ben Shapiro. Like, then even if Danielle Smith's appearance may have not been worth $20,000 worth of fundraising, you know, if the province spent $20,000 or more on it, then we effectively donated 20 grand to PragerU.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I mean, someone commenting on social media put in the context, like, how many H payments is that, right? Which, again, and
$20,000 isn't a lot of money, but it is a lot of H payments.
Yeah, like, you know, you can make the case with the first trip she took to Mar-a-Lago. I don't agree with it, but you could say, okay, look, she's going down, she's, you know, playing good cop and hanging out with Donald Trump and trying to ingratiate herself with him so that he can go easier on.
There's an excerpt from a new episode of The Progress Report. Find the more than 150 episode archives at progressreport.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You'll listen to Harbinger Showcase. And finally, since launching in May 2023, Perspectives, the Broadbent Institute's Journal of Political Economy and Social Democracy, has been bringing left-wing thought and inquiry into public debates and policy for building a more just and equitable Canada. On this excerpt from a new episode, author Naomi Klein delivers remarks at July's 2025 Pan-American Congress in Mexico City, explaining the growing threat of end times fascism. Now, here's the show.
We also cheer and share viral clips of your President Sheinbaum as she meets Trump's attacks with seemingly bottomless dignity and strength. But these leaders need backup from the rest of the countries that Trump is bullying. Now, I regret to report that my own country, Canada, is also failing the Trump test. After winning an election promising to stand up for our sovereignty and the values that make us different from the United States, our new banker prime minister immediately capitulated on nearly every front. He is following Trump's commands on increased military spending. He killed an important plan to tax the big tech companies, and he is also trashing Canada's climate commitments. Now, not all of this is happening because of Trump. Trump, in fact, is just the excuse to do what our own oligarchs wanted all along. And our prime minister harnessed the shock of Trump's annexation and tariff threats to push through their pre-existing wish list, a very common and tired tactic that some of you know I have called the shock doctrine.
Welcome to Perspectives, a Canadian journal of political economy and social democracy. I'm Clement Nokos, editor of Perspectives Journal and director of policy at the Broadbent Institute. At the 2025 Pan-American Congress in Mexico City, held August 1st to 3rd, hosted by Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum and her Morena parliamentary group, Canadian journalist Naomi Klein gave remarks at the Esperanza Ires Theater. The author of The Shock Doctrine, No Logo, and most recently the memoir Doppelganger, presented remarks to delegations at the Pan-American Congress, an annual conference of progressive legislators from Nunavut to Tierra del Fuego, entitled The Rise of End-of-the-World Fascism and Resistance from the Global South. Here's a recording of those remarks presented by the Perspectives Journal podcast.
Gracias. Buenas noches. First, I want to express my deep gratitude to President Sheinbaum and the Morena parliamentary group for hosting us, for showing us so much hospitality in your beautiful city, your love of this place, of this city, of this country, and your joy and pride in all that you have accomplished is infectious. We're a little jealous. It is also such an honor to share the stage with the great Alvaro Garcia Linera. I've learned so much from you over the years, and soon we will be hearing from the mayor herself. I'm so grateful to the organizers of the Pan American Congress, especially David Adler and Giorgio Jackson. This is, as you've heard, a celebration of an emergent solidarity that stretches from Nunavut to Tierra del Fuego. And this forum to share ideas and strategies across our national context arrives just in time, because we have never needed to strengthen the long progressive tradition of internationalism more than in this moment. And I say this for several reasons. Now, I think the first is obvious. The current government of the country with the largest economy and the largest military in the world is attacking each one of our countries in different ways and one at a time. Trump likes to play the mafia boss, and he uses trade and tariff threats not only as a weapon, but also, as we've seen, as a bribe. He turns some countries into concentration camps, others into his mining colonies. Some, like mine, he simply threatens with annexation. And all the while, he terrorizes and immiserates his own people, all to further enrich a small group of oligarchs bent on replacing humans with robots and powering the whole enterprise with fossil fuels that will incinerate our collective home. To this audience, it goes without saying that Washington has a long and bloody history of waging war on the countries of the Americas, using the tools of both tanks and banks, both torture and trade. The reason so many are this vulnerable to US trade wars and trade threats is precisely because the United States used those neocolonial colonies to keep the nations of the Americas dependent on raw resource exports and low-wage labor rather than diversifying their own economies and developing as they wished. So this is not new. Still, I think Trump marks a new phase. In the past, there was a facade. The CIA and the School of the Americas hid in the shadows. The IMF, World Bank, and the so-called free trade deals claimed to be advancing growth-led development that would benefit the whole world. Now, the mask is off. There is not even a pretense that this is about anything other than benefiting the United States, by which Trump means himself and his donors. And there is nothing clandestine about it. It's done out in the open, announced in all caps on Trump's own social media platform, just one of the ways that he directly and defiantly profits from the presidency. In the face of these attacks, every one of our nations, even the largest and wealthiest among them, is at a great disadvantage. That said, so many of us around the world are immensely grateful to President Lula da Silva, who has shown so much courage in the face of Trump's outrageous interference in Brazil's sovereignty. And Brazil's right to prosecute Bolsonaro for involvement in an attempted coup d'etat, which, by the way, is exactly what the US Congress should have done to Trump. Now, we also cheer and share viral clips of your President Sheinbaum as she meets Trump's attacks with seemingly bottomless dignity and strength. But these leaders need backup from the rest of the countries that Trump is bullying. Unfortunately, many have given up far too easily. The EU just gave Trump a tariff victory it had no right to concede, violating many of its stated values, including its climate commitments. For those of you who missed this, the European Union agreed to buy a huge amount of US gas and oil. Now, I regret to report that my own country, Canada, is also failing the Trump test. After winning an election promising to stand up for our sovereignty and the values that make us different from the United States, our new banker prime minister immediately capitulated on nearly every front. He is following Trump's commands on increased military spending, spending money on bombs that we should be spending on health care and caring for one another. He killed an important plan to tax the big tech companies that have poisoned our media ecology. And he is also trashing Canada's climate commitments, scrapping carbon pricing, and ramming through major extractive projects that make a mockery of Canada's promises to respect the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Now, not all of this is happening because of Trump. Trump, in fact, is just the excuse to do what our own oligarchs wanted all along. And our prime minister harnessed the shock of Trump's annexation and tariff threats to push through their pre-existing wish list, a very common and tired tactic that some of you know I have called the shock doctrine. So my friends, we are here because we know that there are other ways to meet this crisis, much better ways, ways rooted in collaboration, in cooperation, in careful coordination, rather than waiting for Trump to pick us off one by one. So what might this mean? It's not a secret. In each of our nations, we know what the US wants most from us. Perhaps it is lithium, perhaps it's copper or coffee. Maybe it's fresh produce or water or electricity generation. Maybe it's car parts or access to ports and canals. Whatever it is, I believe that it is time for all of us in the Americas and around the world to find those points of greatest leverage, our levers, and make it absolutely clear that if these outrageous attacks continue, we are willing to pull them, not one at a time, which makes us vulnerable to isolation and even worse counter threats, but all at once. Wasn't it Nixon who said of Allende's Chile, "Make the economy scream"? Two can play at that game. Then let's see who knows more about the art of the deal. This, after all, is what the rich history of trade unionism teaches us. No boss, no matter how wealthy and powerful, can get anything done without his or her workers who have the power to withdraw their labor. This is the tactic through which the left has won its greatest victories, from the five-day work week to national health care, and it has overthrown dictators and even abolished slavery before. As the left, we know the power of solidarity in the face of bullying. We are experts in how to deploy collective power in the face of concentrated wealth. And there is enormous power in this room, enormous power in the Pan-American Congress, which has convened 60 elected legislators from 12 countries from South, Central, and North America. I believe it's time to map that power, organize it, and if Trump refuses to stop violating our sovereignty, breaking the US's own rules, it is time to deploy it. I want to be clear that this is not a threat against the hardworking people of the United States. It's the opposite. No one benefits more than them when their would-be dictator, their want-to-be king, is revealed to be a paper tiger. Our solidarity extends to everyone in the United States who deserves so much better, especially those who have been in the streets holding No Kings protests and who have organized to stop ICE, the immigration police, from entering their neighborhoods, schools, and workplaces to disappear people. And it extends to the brave members of the U.S. Congress who are here this week in Mexico showing us what it means to not just be anti-Trump, but to try to transform the whole broken system that made Trump possible. These are some of my personal heroes. So there's a second reason that we are called to new levels of international cooperation. And it goes well beyond one man and one government. Though Trump is indeed a threat to us all. He is, however, only the most visible manifestation of a far-right political project that has national expressions in all of our countries. It's a project backed by the wealthiest tech and fossil fuel companies on the planet, as well as some of the largest and fastest-growing fundamentalist religious orders. It's a project that has weaponized the most violent and apocalyptic passages in the Bible, Old and New Testament, and combined them with the most potent tools of digital misinformation to spread fear and division. Fear that justifies placing nations in constant state of emergency, waging war on migrants, on gangs, on woke, anything to justify ever-escalating repression, criminalization, and incarceration.
As a highlight from a recent episode of the Perspectives podcast, find out more at perspectivesjournal.ca, at broadbentinstitute.ca, and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode has been brought to you by Unraked. Learn more about Canada's coalition of more than 31 progressive publishers and get all your progressive news, videos, and podcasts in one place at unraked.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Harbinger Tweets and on Instagram at Media Harbinger and now Blue Sky for updates on new episodes, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
My name is William, and you're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
Studio 6, CJSF's video series, captures high-quality video recordings of live performances.
So, you've released some demos now, that titled coincidentally Demos.
It's just called Demos right now, yeah.
And interviews with impactful and inspiring artists.
Well, we're going to go on a tour. Okay, we're playing Sled Island, which will be sick. We're very excited for that.
Yes,
and we're playing Music Waste, also very excited for that. so that makes it easy. and I think we're going to probably record soon.
As well as engaging conversations with community members about the issues that are most important to their communities. Watch all of the Studio 6 live sessions on CJSF's YouTube page or on our website at cjsf.ca/studio6.